from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the Segments Podcast. Now, here's your weekly roundup in arts coverage. Over the past couple of months, In the Moment has really been diving into this question of what is the future of faith in South Dakota? And in conversations amongst ourselves as staff and with a couple of our guests, oftentimes we hear about people wrestling with the idea that there's a major conflict between science and faith. And so we really wanted to get to the bottom of the question of what is the compatibility of modern faith and modern science. More specifically, in this segment, we talk about physics and Catholicism. Let's take a listen.
Stephen Barr, he's a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Delaware. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Also with us, Dr. Joseph Bottom. Welcome back.
Thanks, Lori.
And Dr. Barr, let's talk about your role in physics and then also in faith. And the first thing I want to know is if your entire life have you had to answer questions about whether these two things are compatible, or has it been something that you've been, you know, following this thread to saying, you know, these are two, you know, really important parts of who I am, and I want to think more deeply about them?
Actually, the latter. I mean, from time to time, I am asked, by people, religious people included, whether I have any difficulty reconciling being a scientist and being a person of faith. But actually, I've been thinking about such questions since I was quite young, since my teenage years. As you say, these are two, for me, part ways of making sense of the world. I've always been a Catholic, and I've always been scientific in my outlook. And it's important for me that everything hold together in a coherent way. And as part of the reason why I'm a physicist, I like to see how things fit together coherently and make sense. And so it was important that that the religious picture of the world and the scientific picture fit together in a coherent fashion.
What direction is your physics research taking right now? What are you interested in?
Well, actually, I've just retired as a professor at the University of Delaware in January, so I could spend full time. I'm 66, so I thought it was not a bad time to retire and spend full time on science faith questions, because I'm the president of something called the Society of Catholic Scientists, which started in 2016, and that's in itself a full-time job. But I have been doing research for over 40 years, and my field of research was theoretical particle physics. So that has to do with things like quarks and neutrinos.
Thank you. Because I needed a minute to process that. I appreciate you filling in that blank.
Other physicists think we're arrogant because people in particle physics tend to think that we're doing the most fundamental physics, because the goal of the field of particle physics is to find out what are the fundamental constituents out of which everything is made, and what are the fundamental laws, and what are the fundamental forces. So that in a nutshell is what particle physics is all about.
All right, so how does faith fit into that then? Is that part of the daily conversations that you have? Is it something, I guess what I'm really trying to get at here, Dr. Barr, is just, you know, how they intersect in your daily life.
Faith questions don't come up in one's work as a physicist any more than in one's work if one is a religious baseball player, auto mechanic, or you know.
Sure.
Physics, frankly, is a very technical. It's a technical skill. Physics deals with a certain limited range of questions about how the physical world works, and whereas faith is a much broader, deals with deeper and broader questions. But I would say there is a connection in this. There are many connections, but one connection is this: that one of the traditional arguments for the existence of God goes way back to Scripture and to early Christian writers, is that the world is an orderly and lawful place. That was always regarded as one of the main arguments for the existence of God. It explains why the world is orderly and lawful, and our job as physicists is to uncover uncover what those laws are and to explore the orderliness, show how the world is orderly.
For people who are saying, is the world really orderly and lawful? What's your response as a physicist?
Well, there's
because
a lot
sometimes
of,
it just doesn't seem like it, right? Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, as far as events go, I mean, there's a lot of haphazardness and chance and so on in the world. It's not rigidly ordered. Everything doesn't move in lockstep, which you wouldn't expect if there's a God, because if everything were so rigidly ordered by the laws of nature, there would be no scope for, you know, responsible beings like ourselves. But yeah, one thing that's been discovered as in the history of physics, especially in the last 100 years, is how profound the order of nature is. Nature is based upon very deep mathematical laws, which exhibit very rich and intricate and subtle mathematical structure. The world's not built with Legos, you know. It's based on very deep mathematical ideas. So actually, that's something that the modern physics has, in a way, strengthened the argument for God, because it's shown us how incredible the order of nature is at the deepest level.
Mm. Dr. Joseph Bottom, this is something you think about from your own, discipline. And talk a little bit, if you will, Dr. Bottom, about interdisciplinary conversations like this, because not everyone is going to study, you know, physics at this level or mathematics or you know, a million different things. But putting things in the same room and having these conversations creates something new, doesn't it?
It does. You know, not everybody's going to think about physics in the same way as not everybody's going to think about medicine. And yet, you know, I like that analogy because we all do eventually end up having to think about medicine as we grow old and sickly. And in the same way, you know, we all encounter at least that our lives seem to be filled with truths. There are truths in poetry. There are truths in our faith lives. There are truths that we perceive about the physical universe. And the deep commitment that you call interdisciplinary is finally, you know, comes to us best phrased by Thomas Aquinas, after whom this lecture is named, which is the unity of truth. That if we're really committed to a world that makes sense, if we think that it's possible to know things, then we can't live with double truth, as though, well, there are things that are true in poetry, but they're not true in physics, or there are truths in theology that I believe are true on Sunday morning at church, and then there are truths of commerce that I believe Monday through Friday. If there's a unity of truth, if all the pieces of truth have to fit together to satisfy us as human beings, then these kinds of conversations reflect our experience in the world, ordinary people's experience in the world, and they are of profound importance, not just to physicists and not just to theologians, but to ordinary people living their lives as best they can. Now, physicists tend to be a little bit arrogant. It was a famous physicist who once said, physics is the only science. Everything else that calls itself science is basically just application. And, you know, dismissing chemistry and biology and all the rest. It's not something you hear chemists say about their own discipline. But what Steve has been working on and is reflected in other physicists is this idea that physics itself leads us to this question of the unity of truth. When we all learned Newtonian physics in high school, you remember this, Lorraine, you rolled mm-hmm. the ball down the ramp.
Sure.
That's Newton's Principia. You shone a flashlight through a prism to get the rainbow. That's Newton's optics. What we forget, and what was not in our high school textbooks of Newtonian physics, was that Newton himself, in the Principia, his massive and important work on, you know, that founded physics for hundreds of years, Newton included what Steve described to us as the argument from design. The book ends with a note saying he has looked at the universe and he has perceived order. And the only thing he's perceived governance. And the only thing that makes that make sense is if there is the numinous, the divine. And so, you know, Steve's not the first physicist to reach out in this way and demand the unity of truth and to think that his own discipline leads him to the unity of truth. And he won't be the last. What makes Steve interesting is the way he tries to fold, and I believe succeeds, to fold his truly advanced knowledge and understanding of physics with an advanced knowledge of theology.
Dr. Barr, expand on what Dr. Bodman was saying there, and hopefully you can answer a question I have as well, because the whole point of this lecture is to bring these conversations to, as Jody said, that, you know, the ordinary person who's really just trying to, you know, to get through life in the best way that they can, both with science, advanced science, and theology. There are so many of these ordinary people, of the rest of us, who have at some point felt that these conversations are not for us. You can only go so far in science unless, you know, you're not smart enough to understand this thing, which is really just how the physical universe is, you know, we're all in this physical universe, and yet we're told that in some ways we can't understand that. And we're also, so many people have felt left out of the church in, you know, various ways because they've been told that they can't fully understand the nature of God. This is something the church has wrestled with. It's something that science wrestles with as they try to get people to understand, you know, high-level scientific thinking and research. Talk a little bit, if you will, Steve, about this idea of these things being for all of us.
Well, yes. I mean, I don't think it's necessary, for example, to be a deeply religious person, to be a very saintly person, to have a very sophisticated knowledge of theology. I mean, the people who are important in the church are not the theologians as much as the saints, and you don't need to have a deep knowledge of mathematical physics to appreciate the wonders of nature. So, for example, one thing I talk about is the beauty of everyone can appreciate the beauty of nature, the beauty of sunsets, the beauty of the things that the Hubble Space Telescope shows us, marvelous pictures of planets and galaxies, nebula, and so on. Everyone can appreciate that aspect of nature, and that is actually what points to God. As when I say the order of nature, the orderliness, the lawfulness, that also includes the harmoniousness, the beauty of nature. And so the traditional argument wasn't just that nature is orderly and lawful, but that it's harmonious and beautiful, and that, I think, can speak to everybody. Is it one way to see the divine? One of the great scientists, one of the founders of modern science 400 years ago, Johannes Kepler, he discovered some mathematical laws, beautiful laws, governing the motion of planets. And he wrote this prayer. He said, "I thank you, Lord God, our Creator, that you have allowed me to see the beauty in your work of creation." And so that actually has been the attitude of the great scientists for centuries, actually until relatively recently in scientific history, is that the science was a way, was revealing the wonders of nature and how deep the beauty of nature goes. In fact, one of the great scientists, he was an Anglican, he's considered really the first modern chemist, the founder of chemistry, back in the 1600s, said the best day to do scientific experiments was Sunday because it was a form of worship. So I think that one doesn't have a lot of esoteric knowledge to appreciate some of the really important
So what do you think? Do you believe? What does it mean to you to believe? Is it verbally stating I do? Or is it the actions and behaviors by which you conduct yourself? Is believing in God behaving as though God exists? Do you have a right to say you believe? Our next guest has a mother who lives with Alzheimer's disease. And during this next segment, I ask you, what is it that proves she loves her mother? Words or action?
Kimberly, welcome back.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your mother, as you remember her as a younger woman and that connection with music.
My mom loved music, and as I grew up, she always had the record player on or the radio, and she had stacks and stacks of the small 45s that we would play on the record player, and she would put them on, and she would teach my sisters and I. I'm the middle of three girls. We're 11 months apart. God bless my mother. And she would get us out dancing to all of the greats. She loved Elvis Presley. She loved the country greats. And she taught us to jitterbug and twist. And she just absolutely loved music.
Tell me a little bit about living with her now and visiting her now.
You know, I grew up in North Iowa, and so that's about a 9-hour trip back to visit my family. And when I go back to see Mom, she's in a unit now, and her Alzheimer's has progressed to the point where the last time she really spoke anything to me was 2 years ago. And it was a moment in that I walked in with my guitar, and I had it in the case, and I sat down in front of her, and she didn't know who I was, but I could tell in her eyes she knew I was her people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She knew I was somebody to her, and she brushed my hair back from my eyes and couldn't say my name, and I gave her hugs and what have you. And then I went over and I opened up my guitar case, and for years I had played this black guitar. And even though at that point Mom didn't know my name, didn't know anything, when I opened up that guitar case, she looked at me, and she still calls me Kimmy to this day. She looked right at me and said, "Kimmy, did you get a new guitar?" And I said, "Yes, Mom, I did." And she said, "What happened to your black one?" And I said, "I traded it for this new Teton guitar." And then she was gone. Mm-hmm. And that was the last real conversation that I had with her, was 2 years ago. And it's amazing to me the connection that music has for her and her family. You know, it just bonds us together. She is only 75 years old. This all started when she was 67. She began having little accidents, and she couldn't really organize a Christmas dinner, and she made some poor decisions, and she began giving away a lot of stuff, and it began to make my sisters and I suspect that something was going on with her.
Yeah. We are still learning so much. I mean, the push for research on Alzheimer's disease is moving forward, but yet it seems like we have such a long ways to go. But one of the things that is really being explored in medical research is the ability of music to unlock part of the brain, even temporarily, and how that door can be opened. Are you seeing, I mean, you're not a scientist, you're not a medical researcher, but what does an artist have to contribute to that conversation, what that you see as you do the work that you're doing with your mother and with others?
Yes, that is, from an artist standpoint, that is the great mystery. Why is it that a baby learns to dance and recognize music first? Why is it when you're in your elderly years and you may have Alzheimer's that music is still a connection? That is the great unanswered mystery, but it's almost spiritual, I feel, in that that is a question that will be answered when we cross over. We will know why music is a great spiritual connection for all of us. And yes, I do see that. I see people who cannot even recognize their family members, but yet sing every word to Amazing Grace, every word to some old Patsy Cline song. That is a mystery. You know it when their face lights up and they break into the words. It's amazing from an artist's standpoint to feel that connection with them.
You've written a song for your mother that we're going to play the entire song right now. And I usually don't warn listeners unless something, sensitive is coming up. But you might cry at this song. So I will tell you, if you're driving your car, you might want to think about your safety, because I cry when I hear this song, Kimberly Kay. So tell us just a little bit about what this song is called and why you wrote it.
The song is called She Saw Me, and it is a song that came out of me after the guitar episode with my mom. After that visit, I came back home to South Dakota, and that song just fell out of my heart in 20 minutes. I wrote it and recorded it, sent it into the studio. It just felt right, and it was a moment of clarity where my mom saw me, and then she was gone. And I think it speaks volumes to those who are going through this journey with a loved one.
Here's the song.
Well, I saw my mom today, though she wasn't there. She was staring out the window, sitting in her favorite chair. She was walking the hall. She's walked a million times a day. I saw my mom today, though she's far away. She holds my hand, we sit a while. She's unaware. This disease has been so hard on her. It just isn't fair. But she sings at peace her days go. Stare out the window, and I begin to cry. And suddenly, there's my mom. Her eyes light up, she smiles and laughs, and then she's gone.
I've always loved how artists like Kimberly Kay take something subjective and have it carry within it truths that get to the core of our own existence. American country singer and songwriter Heath Johnson does just that. And he joined us for this week's Moment in Sound.
What will you play for us first?
Yeah, so I'm going to play Leave This Place first. And it's the song I was just talking about. You know, I was scrolling through Facebook, and I have lots of friends that have a comment on every, you know, political or social topic these days. And it's, sometimes I feel like it's all they do is sit and socialize online about everything going on. And I just don't have the time to do that. You know, not that I don't think about it or process through it, but to me, I just wonder sometimes how much of our time is spent talking about it when there's like little things we can do right in front of us to make things better. And yeah, that's where this song came out of. So,
Heath Johnson on Moment in Sound.
I think I'd rather just say nothing on all the topics of the times. It seems to me nobody listens, just want repeats of their kind, repeats of their kind, repeats of their kind. 'Cause high and low I hear them screaming to make their mark on history. They say, I don't want to be forgotten when time marches over me, marches over me, marches over me. But I don't think I'm gonna worry about that right now, 'cause I got kids to raise. I don't know if I'll be known for anything after I leave this place, and that's okay. We all want to be remembered when all is said and done. But will those future generations think we got it wrong? Think we got it wrong? Maybe we got it wrong. Because today I watched the TV. Those talking heads, they sure were riled over something that somebody said so long ago, and I just sat there and smiled, shook my head and smiled. But I don't think I'm gonna worry about that right now, 'cause I got bills to pay. I don't know if I'll be known for anything after I leave this place, and that's okay. 'Cause I don't think I'm gonna worry about that right now, 'cause I got kids to raise. I don't know if I'll be known for anything after I leave this place, and that's okay.
Already, it feels like the song that we all need right now.
Well, I mean, I don't know. It kind of hit me in a good spot. A lot of times it takes me a lot longer to write a song than that one did.
Yeah.
But it just, like, if I fail at the things right in front of me, you know, what do I have to say about the things that I have no connection to whatsoever as far as being actively involved and changing? And, you know, there's a lot of opinions and a lot of thoughts out there. And, I mean, sometimes it's just, well, this is what I can fix. And let me focus on that. And if I'm forgotten, if my name's not in a history book because I didn't put this on Twitter about that topic, I'm okay. You got to be okay with that. You know, that's all right.
Because when we think about, division and coming together, when we think about influence, even musical influences, you know, you could talk a long time probably about the artists who have influenced you, but isn't it really the people in your lives, in your personal life, that have influenced you more?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everyone has heroes and, you know, artistical heroes and, you know, people that we all look up to, you know, culturally, you know, but when I think of what shapes my writing or me as a person, it's the people that I come in contact with and the people that make me want to be a better version of myself today than I was yesterday.
Yeah. So. Let's talk a little bit about the podcast, because when we think about things that are right in front of us, mm-hmm. we live in this community with artists who are right here at your local, you know, brewery, you know, local venue playing.
Yeah.
Tell us how the Heath Bar kind of started, and then how has it evolved for you to be in conversation with so many people?
Yeah, well, it hit me this couple years ago now that, you know, the podcast movement was, it's really big now, but a few years back it was still kind of on the, you know, upward motion of that, and a lot of people still were knowing what it was and whatnot, but it hit me that, you know, there's a lot of musicians and artists, not just musicians, but artists around this area that have a story and what got them into it and why they're doing what they're doing. You know, we hear them playing out on the weekends out when we go out to eat or go out to have a few drinks and or go to shows. And it's like, well, who's the person behind the stage? You know, what's their story? What are they like? And that's where the idea for the podcast came about, was sitting down with, you know, local and regional artists of any kind, even, you know, leaders in that. I've talked to a few like film producers and you know, things like that as well, and just who are they, you know, what would it be like if you just sat down and talked to them for an hour or so? And that's where it came from, and I named it the Heath Bars because I was trying to be clever, you know, and a friend told me you got to put your name in it, otherwise you're, you know, it's easier to brand yourself if your name's in something. So
how does it change you then when you're creating your own music to mm-hmm. sort of be, because every time we have these conversations, I leave the conversation as a different, I mean, you know, it's fulfilling, it's artistically challenging sometimes. Mm-hmm. Is that, do you have the same experience where every person you talk to leaves their imprint on Heath a little bit?
100%. Yeah, it's definitely a challenge to talk to the incredible people and the skills and talents that they have and then walk away going, man, I should get better, you know, because they're really good. And you know, I'm happy and I'm proud of myself and where I'm at musically in that. But, you know, constantly interacting with, you know, people I call friends and seeing them improve, you know, keeps you at it. It keeps me at it anyway, and helps me, you know, not let it become a, you know, a hobby I used to do a decade or so ago.
Right. And those conversations, as I listen to that podcast, they're relaxed. That's one of the things that I really appreciate, is like, man, he's completely comfortable in his space. And I aspire to be that sometimes. You know, sometimes I'm like, oh, if I could stop looking at that clock. And you say on your website, you know, that, and I believe this for this show that we do, it's rare to sit in conversation with somebody uninterrupted for such an extended period of time. I think that's one of the reasons why these conversations on In the Moment, conversations on your podcast resonate with people. Sometimes you think, who's going to listen to us talk for 40 minutes about, and a lot of people do.
Yeah, a lot of people. Well, that's one of the fun things with, you know, podcasting, is there's no time limits. You can do what you want. Some of them, I listen to some that go 3 to 5 hours, and I enjoy every second of it.
Yeah.
Because that's real life. You know, that's what life is like when you're out talking with someone, you know, and you do a really good job of making people feel comfortable too, because I feel great. But that's the thing, you know, if you cut things down to sound bites here or there, you know, anything can mean anything, you know, but if you're really get to know someone, I think there's a lot more we have in common with each other, and you really get the feel of who a person is, you know, versus a, you know, a quick bit here or there.
Yeah. And conversation can be a radical act.
Absolutely.
In and of
Absolutely.
Itself. Do you find that, you know, because, again, I'm asking a question that I have answered for myself, which is maybe breaking the rules of this format, but this sense that sometimes it's the artists who have more to say towards something than maybe you know, a political leader might. That there are so many people who are on and have their talking points and are trying to make sure they get their point across. You bring in an artist, a poet, mm-hmm. a filmmaker, and that door opens up and you start realizing how much influence these people have on our culture.
Yeah, well, and the artist doesn't have all the pressures of making sure they say or do the right thing for whatever, you know, agenda they've got, you know, behind them, whether it's politics or anything like that. Like, there's certain things you just can and can't say. And an artist can be as free as they want. And a lot of times that freedom is the truth of what people are feeling and yeah. want to say and can't. And, you know, it's a privilege, you know, but it's also a big responsibility of being willing to take some heat sometimes if you need to.
Yeah. Right. What will you play for us next here today?
The next one is the title track off the EP. It's called Waking Up. And this comes out of a few dreams that I had a while ago of just thinking about my past and thinking about where my life was at that moment and, you know, where it is now, and just realizing that they're two very different things, and finding myself sometimes longing for what I don't have anymore, and then learning to be okay with, you know, where life has gone. So,
all right. Heath Johnson on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
It never stops. It never goes away. You just find a way to live with it every day. And some days it seems you only want the dream. And waking up feels just like letting go. But don't stare too long, 'cause you know you still got heartache hiding there. Don't get me wrong, boy, I just don't want you up all night. And it feels like home is so far away. Where you lay your head's just where you stay. Because you can't leave, you can't see that you'll always be waiting for someday. Don't stare too long, boy, 'cause you know you still got heartache hiding. Don't get me wrong, boy, I just don't want you up all night. Don't stare too long, boy, 'cause you know you still got heartache hiding there. Don't get me wrong, boy, I just don't want you up all night. So dry your eyes, look outside, let the life that you have come flooding back. And then breathe in deep, then let it be. Let the path rise up to meet your feet. Let your path rise up to meet your feet.
We've been having these conversations on In the Moment lately about the future of faith. Hmm. And what we're hearing from a lot of people is, is a real opening to what they once thought was true, Some people who have been damaged, you know, through the process of, you know, being in a church, for example. Other people who are really rethinking what it means to express their faith in the world. There are songs on this EP that really deal with where do we find truth, for example. Where does truth exist? And, you know, who are the preachers in modern day life? I'd like to hear some of your thoughts about how you kind of process that musically and then in your personal life as well.
Yeah, well, a lot of it, I guess personally for me first, it comes from pain and things that I've experienced in the past and just learning to work through those things. You know, when you spend, you know, an exorbitant amount of money at a Bible college going through, you know, theology training and that, and you come out on the other end thinking, wait a second, I don't get this anymore. That's something that you really wrestle with and struggle with. And so learning to figure out how that molds into who I am now has been a challenge and a struggle. Because there's certainly, you know, a reason stories last as long as 2,000-6,000 years. I mean, there's got to be a reason for it. And finding out why has been, I think, where I've been at is, you know, there's still lessons and truths that can be found, whether or not you believe the spirituality aspect of it. But sometimes a story is a story just to get a lesson across. And that's been, I think, a saving grace for me, is realizing that I didn't waste a lot of my younger life. Like, there's things that have propelled me to where I am now and shaped the way I see the world today.
Yeah. And likewise, then, every song that you record, every song that you don't record, everything that fails, you know, and the you know, a song that just doesn't work, and you lay it aside, all yeah. that sort of feeds into the future of who you are as well, right?
It does, yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of songs that I've written out of that journey that have been just laying on the cutting floor. Like, I was just too angry when I wrote this. Mm-hmm. I don't actually think that or feel that. And the ones that I share and I play out are the ones that I feel are a little bit more nuanced, that, you know, could easily be taken for someone that's gone through what I've gone through, but could also mean, you know, a bunch of other different things for just people in their walk and in their discovery of what is true and what's yet to be discovered yet.
Yeah. So. One more song. What will you play with this?
Yep. So this one's called Grave Robber, and it comes a lot out of kind of the faith that we were talking about as I just move through life and kind of looking back, wondering if there's things that I've laid to rest that I should still have with me and should bring up, and looking for anything that maybe is still worth keeping around. So,
yes. Heath Johnson on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
I've been walking around a graveyard in my mind, and chasing any shiny thing that catches my eye, and hoping all the ghosts I find here somehow are alive. I've been walking around a graveyard in my mind. Been digging up the bones I buried deep, thinking that I missed something when I laid them down to sleep. Because the seeds that I've been sowing don't reflect all that I've reaped. I've been digging up the bones I buried deep. Oh, I am a grave robber, stealing find. And I know there must be something there, everything I left behind. I've been clawing at the ashes of the past, scraping all the dead away to see what is steadfast. All the gold I'm holding just don't seem like it can last. I've been clawing at the ashes of the past. Oh, I am a grave robber, stealing whatever I find. And I everything I left behind. Oh, I am a grave robber, stealing whatever I find. I know there must be something there. Everything I left behind, and everything I left behind, and everything I left behind.
And staying in the realm of beautiful lyricism, I think it's time for some poetry.
This is Poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Barbara Crooker. She was born on November 21, 1945, in Cold Spring, New York. After completing high school, she attended Rutgers University, where she graduated with a BA in 1967. She then went to Elmira College for a master's in education. Crooker taught at a number of institutions of higher education throughout the 1970s and turned to writing when her first daughter was stillborn. A prolific poet, her work often focuses on family and her children. This is especially true of her son, David, who was diagnosed with autism at the age of 2. Of this, Crooker has said, "It's a huge paradox to live with, having some faculty with language myself, while having a child for whom language isn't necessary." Her books include Radiance, Line Dance, Gold, Small Rain, The Book of Kells, and Some Glad Morning. She has won a variety of awards, including the Pen and Brush Poetry Prize, the W.B. Yeats Society of New York Award, the Thomas Merton Poetry of the Sacred Award, and the Patterson Award for Literary Excellence. She has been a finalist for the Pushcart 50 times, and she has also been a finalist for a Grammy. Her work has appeared on the BBC, on the Australian Broadcasting Company, and on National Public Radio. She lives and writes in Pennsylvania. Today's poem is Book of Kells. If you've ever had the good fortune to visit Dublin, there is an excellent chance you've seen one of the treasures of that city. The Book of Kells is an illuminated manuscript that was created by Irish monks around the year 800 AD. It's a large book, some 280 pages in length, and it's a reproduction of the four Gospels of the New Testament. It's written in breathtakingly beautiful calligraphy, and it's painted in vibrant reds, purples, and yellows. There are also fine drawings of humans, mystical animals, and intricate Celtic knots. Most striking of all, it is inlaid with generous amounts of gold leaf. This is what makes it an illuminated manuscript. Such ancient books are called illuminated because, if read by candlelight, as was often the case back then, the flickering flame would make the Word of God appear to shimmer. It appeared to be alive, illuminated. The book itself is named after the Abbey of Kells in Ireland. It was associated with this monastery for centuries before it was brought to the library at Trinity College Dublin in 1661. That we have the Book of Kells at all is something of a minor miracle. It survived numerous Viking raids in the 10th century, which means the monks must have hid it very well. Given how decorated and intricate this 1,200-year-old book is, chances are that it rested on the high altar at Kells, and that it was used only for Mass. It was probably not used for educational purposes. As with any handwritten manuscript, sometimes mistakes were made by the scribes, and when this happened, the Irish monks crossed the errant word out and then had an arrow pointing to a box of red dots on the side. In some cases, the monks who created this invaluable masterpiece drew little birds on the side of the page to entertain themselves, or they sometimes doodled Celtic loops. Not surprisingly, illuminated manuscripts fell out of favor when Johannes Gutenberg invented the printing press in 1450. It would be another 500 years before an illuminated Bible would be created, and it happened in Collegeville, Minnesota, when the monks of St. John's Abbey commissioned the St. John's Bible. Work was begun in 1999, and it was finished in 2011. It is astoundingly beautiful, and I'm sure the monks of Kells would approve of what the monks of Collegeville have created. Before I read our poem for today, I should point out that a Catholic priest named Henri Nouwen is mentioned in the last few lines. He was interested in spirituality, community, and social justice. His contemporary and modern words are an appropriate way to end this poem about an ancient manuscript. This is Book of Kells by Barbara Crooker. The text of the day is open to Luke, chapter 16, verse 10. The initial N, made up of blond men facing off, grappling and tugging at each other's beards, becomes the first word in the section that warns us that no servant can serve two masters. Irony intended. Later, in beautiful insular majuscule, the open letters filled in red and blue, we read, "You cannot serve both God and money." I wish that these words would rise off the page, a swarm of bees, become honey to spread on our daily bread. When the scribes made an error in a world before whiteout, the correct word was inserted in a box of red dots. Aren't there words today we'd like to amend like that? In this dimly lit room, circling glass cases, I return to view the same vellum over again, 1,200 years later, clear as the day it was written. I think of Henri Nouwen. The word is born in silence, and silence is the deepest response to the word.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. This episode was recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you have a story idea, send an email to moment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.